Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. Quick, who was the world's first economist in all history? Well, a lot of people would say Adam Smith, who lived and worked in the 18th century and who authored The Wealth of Nations. Now, who is the world's foremost economist throughout history? Well, a lot of people would answer Adam Smith again. We've progressed since he first wrote The Wealth of Nations, but by adding to his work, not contradicting it. And so we decided to devote an episode to the thought of Adam Smith in the company of one of America's best economic minds, Lawrence Reed, president of the Foundation for Economic Education, who spoke to me from Atlanta. Professor Reed, Adam Smith has gone into this kind of pantheon where everybody quotes him. There's Adam Smith this and Adam Smith that. But actually, very few people have really read him, and I'm told that even you would be cautious with your students. You would tell your students not necessarily to read the whole thing at first, because there's a lot of material in there. So let's go back together to the 18th century. It's the year of American independence, and Adam Smith publishes An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. Now, what's in there?
Well, I think it's interesting to point out from the start, Bob, that he chose a very interesting title for his book. He didn't just call it The Wealth of Nations, as we often abbreviate it today. He called it An Inquiry into the Nature and the Causes of the Wealth of Nations. And the reason for that is he wasn't concerned so much with poverty as we are today. He would have viewed that as sort of the natural state of things. Poverty is what happens when you don't do anything. But he wanted to know, well, how is it that humans are able to pull themselves out of poverty and achieve wealth? And so his book really is devoted to the process by which we accomplish that. And he illuminated our understanding of things like trade and the cost of things, the division of labor, how people come together from disparate parts of the globe to cooperate and produce goods. He illuminated our understanding of self-interest and why self-interest is channeled in free economies into constructive, positive, and productive directions. He really took a rather scattered subject and defined it and put it on a path to becoming a discipline of its own.
And the system he was attacking, because this is a revolutionary book, he's attacking the system. That system was called mercantilism. What is that?
Well, mercantilism was the system of economic organization that was widely practiced from about 1500 until 1800, when it changed thanks largely to the influence of Smith. Mercantilism was set or based upon a number of flawed ideas. One was that the world's wealth was fixed, there was only so much, and that had foreign policy implications. If you were a national leader who believed that, who thought the world's wealth was fixed, then you probably felt that the way for your country to get richer would be to go colonize another country or go to war and take what you want. Smith explained to us that you can bake a bigger pie, so to speak, that the world's wealth is not fixed, that you create a bigger pie for more people through things like trade, investment, production, free prices, entrepreneurship. Those are the kinds of things he talked about. But in mercantilist days, they were so focused on regulating trade, trying to generate a favorable balance of trade, trying to encourage the inflow of gold and silver and the outflow of goods. Smith looked at all of that and said that's based on very flawed concepts. And because he was so eloquent in exploding the ideas of mercantilism, he really put much of the world by the late 18th century on a path toward freer markets and free enterprise.
And one of the fascinating things I found is that the book comes out in 76, and as you say, by 1800, its effect is already being felt. And he dies in 1790, and it's a bestseller in his lifetime. And normally, when a book challenges all the assumptions of a society, its effect is not felt immediately. The pushback is much longer and stronger than that.
That's right. In one sense, Smith was benefited by the fact that the world was ready for new ideas. We had just seen the period of the Enlightenment, when people had begun to question notions long held of aristocratic rule and absolute monarchy. So Smith comes along and says, hey, you know, your suspicions about those things are basically right. They really don't work. They're not the natural state of mankind. And that we ought to be looking at things like competition and free enterprise and free prices and entrepreneurship. So his ideas were very eloquently stated, but they also fell upon some very receptive ears at the time.
And how did the powers that be react? After all, he was living in a monarchy in 18th century England, which was facing a revolt in America and fighting that revolt. And along comes Adam Smith, and he attacks the colonial system. He attacks hoarding of gold and silver, exports over imports, all of that. I can't believe that the king didn't want to whack him a bit.
Yeah, I think the king did have some problems with Adam Smith, but this was also a time of the rise of parliamentary powers, and the king was actually on the downslope, you might say, in terms of his powers. And that would continue to be eroded in the 19th century as ideas of Adam Smith and other free market thinkers really took hold. And Parliament said, hey, there are some things that aren't the proper province of the monarch, and even some things that shouldn't be regulated by us, too.
And he did away with the notion that somehow wealth could be equated with gold and silver.
That's right. Smith argued very strongly that what makes a nation wealthy is not the amount of gold and silver that it may pile up. In fact, all the gold and silver in the world, he would argue, would leave you starving if there aren't goods and services to get with it. So ultimately, he said, the wealth of a nation is determined by goods and services, and we become richer to the extent we find ways to make more of them, to improve their quality, to give people more choices, to give them greater access to the goods and services, wherever they may come from, that they most desire.
The most famous metaphor, of course, in the book is the invisible hand, which he takes to as a metaphor for the market. And when Adam Smith says that, he's attacking a command economy in the hands of a monarch, and he's saying there's a much better way: prices, self-interest, people's trade between each other. All those things are so much better at regulating the economy naturally. But even though the phrase is always quoted and has become a cliche, it seems to me we sort of betray it now. We use it as a synonym for the vagaries of the free market, for the excesses of unregulated markets. And in fact, the invisible hand has become evil in the eyes of some people.
Well, in the eyes of some people, yes, and that's unfortunate. What Smith was saying is that unlike the mercantilists of his day and the feudal philosophers before them, he didn't believe that society was just a bunch of people waiting around to be told what to do. And yet he had to explain, if you don't have a monarch or an all-powerful government regulating every aspect of life, telling people what they could buy, what they had to produce, or what they couldn't produce, well, then what takes its place? And he said there is a marvelous mechanism, he called it the invisible hand, of the profit motive, of free prices, that sends signals that tell people this item is in greater demand, therefore more of it should be produced, or it's needed over here as opposed to over there, that you don't need these guys with power pushing people around and making these silly judgments about where goods ought to go, that the marketplace takes care of that infinitely better than any group of commanders or commissars could ever hope to do.
And as a believer in all that, what do you answer to those who say that in 2008, the invisible hand dropped the ball, meaning financial markets had been left too much to themselves? What do you say to that?
Well, I would say to folks who make that argument that they need to do their homework. This was the 2008 crisis was the fault not of the invisible hand, but of the iron fist. It was the fault of government. You had, on the one hand, you had the Federal Reserve System in the United States keeping interest rates artificially low for too long, fueling a boom, flooding the banks with reserves, driving interest rates to historic lows. And then at the same time, you had the Congress and successive administrations jawboning banks to make mortgages or loans to people who really couldn't pay them back. So you had government all over the place. We didn't have laissez-faire before 2008 or hands-off government. You had government all over the place. So when I hear people say it was the invisible hand, I want to say, I think they have a bias there. They're looking for things to pin on the free market instead of doing their actual homework.
And how about those clever financial artists on Wall Street who pile financial product upon financial product upon financial product with no visible goods or services produced, who invented credit default swaps or at least extended them to all kinds of things? Should we let all those guys run amok?
Well, credit default swaps was simply a market mechanism to provide insurance on loan packages. One of the problems with all of that was that you had a government monopoly over the business of rating mortgages and mortgage packages, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, essentially private companies enjoying a monopoly privilege from government that weren't doing their job in properly rating those packages of mortgages. So there's a lot going on here, but government had its fingerprints all over the crisis of 2008. And whenever you flood the economy with lots of easy money and dirt cheap interest rates, you're going to have people fly off in all sorts of directions that they wouldn't do, that wouldn't be profitable in the absence of such easy money. So the problem is not to regulate the outcome so much as to stop the problem from being generated in the first place through things like easy money and bad policies to require banks to make loans they should never make.
You may smile at this, but it's funny, when I was reading about mercantilism, which I really wasn't familiar with before, I saw that structure with the insistence on exports over imports and hoarding and very little consumption and all that, I thought of China. They're doing that to us. They're practicing mercantilism, and it seems to be working. They're selling us all kinds of stuff. They're not forcing us to buy it, of course, we buy it, but they're selling us all kinds of stuff, and they're making a ton of money off us, and they don't want to buy from us. Isn't there a disequilibrium there that is bound to fail?
Well, China does buy from us, but like anyone who sells goods to us, they earn dollars. And, if nothing else happened, if all they did was sell goods to us and they take pieces of paper with pictures of our politicians on them, and that's the end of it, I would say we got the better end of that deal. We get goods and they get paper money. But that isn't the end of it. They turn around and buy some things in our markets with those dollars. Then they may decide they'd rather buy in the German market or the Swiss market or the British market. And then they sell the dollars for euros or pounds or whatever and buy in those markets. So really, trade is much more complicated than the old mercantilist view of mere imports and exports of merchandise. Trade involves the passage of time. It involves sometimes the investment of funds as opposed to the purchase of goods. It involves trade flows with multiple countries and entities. The old mercantilist view really doesn't hold. It doesn't look at what really happens in today's modern competitive markets, where you have trade flows in all directions at all times. It makes little sense, and Adam Smith would certainly argue this, for third parties to look at the trades of other people and say, well, you shouldn't have done it that way. You should have bought more of this or less of that. The fact is, every trader in the market, whatever it is they're buying, whatever it is they're selling, does so because what they feel that what they're getting is worth more than what they're giving up. So trade is a beneficial activity, and that's why we engage in it in the first place.
And Adam Smith was about freedom as well, and as much as about free markets. And I wonder, what would he say about the command economy in China? Because it behaves a lot like the king did in his day. The Chinese decide, well, we'll have roads here, not there. We'll develop this city and not that city. It's very much a command economy. Isn't that likely to collapse at some point?
I think so. I think the command portion of China's economy is, in the long run, untenable. You can't give people significant economic freedom, then of course they benefit from that, and then tell them that, well, it doesn't make sense to give you any more than that. We're going to maintain certain state monopolies and one-party political monopolies. Sooner or later, people say, wait a minute, if it makes sense for us to be a little bit free, why shouldn't we be freer yet? So, you know, China experienced a full-blown command economy where there was very little private property, total control of the economy by the government, and as has been the case everywhere that's been tried, it was a complete flop. So in the last 30 to 40 years, China has allowed a significant degree of economic freedom, and lo and behold, their economy's taken off. It's taken off because of the degree of freedom they've granted, not because of the command economy part that they still have.
One of the really witty, memorable lines, amusing lines in the book, is where Adam Smith is talking about self-interest, and he says, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the baker, and the brewer that we can expect our dinner. It's from their regard to their own interest. And I think that idea by now has totally penetrated the world economy, you know, that self-interest is something that propels societies and individuals forward, and that is how we all better ourselves. But isn't there a tipping point when it approaches outright greed? Gordon Gekko's greed is good speech, and we don't want to go there. At some point, can there not be an excess of self-interest turning into greed?
Adam Smith would say, and I would agree with him on this, that self-interest is a powerful and almost always very constructive motive. It's what explains so much of production. In fact, you look around at all the things you use on any given day, how much of it was created by people who just wanted to do you a favor? Almost none of it. It was all produced by people who were doing it because there was some reason for them to do it in terms of the benefit to them. Now, when you take that desire to improve yourself to an extreme, where you are willing to use force or fraud or deception or your political connections to get something at other people's expense through the force of law, then even Adam Smith would say that's taking it too far, it's abusing it. He wanted self-interest to be actualized in a free market where respect for lives and property are paramount, and where government rules are limited to protecting the peace, not to passing out special favors.
As I read more about Adam Smith, his persona, his historical figure, reminded me of Isaac Newton, but with one important difference. Isaac Newton, his physics were never contested, but they evolved. The science evolved and into many different things, and many physicists came along with radically different theories that push the science forward, to the extent that I think Isaac Newton would have trouble recognizing the physics of today. Whereas, in the case of Adam Smith, it's not only highly readable today, but it's what most economists are still saying. So in a sense, you know, he wrote the book, and everybody else is doing footnotes, or am I exaggerating?
Well, there were discoveries in economics yet to be made, but he certainly laid an important foundation. And it reverberates throughout all schools of economic thought to this day, and I believe always will. He was the first man to take economics out of its corner, you might say, within something called moral philosophy, bring it forward, make it a separate and identifiable discipline of its own, and he gave us some important foundations in our understanding of economic life that no school of thought will ever erase. So his influence was and is profound, and probably always will be.
I read somewhere that the British Empire is believed by some historians to have done so much better and have flourished more than other empires of the same era because they took hold of Adam Smith's ideas and applied them, whereas other colonial powers were using other colonial models. Is that your view?
Absolutely. The British in the 19th century, largely motivated by Enlightenment ideas, and especially those of Adam Smith, really becomes the capital of capital, the freest free trade country in the world. And as a result, the United States would not exceed per capita income in Britain until the eve of World War I. So Britain really dominated the world in the 19th century and was able to do so because it had the strongest economy, founded primarily upon ideas of free trade and ever smaller government. My favorite prime minister in British history was a man named William Ewart Gladstone. And he was greatly influenced by Adam Smith, and by the time he was, the fourth time he was prime minister in the 1890s, he was able to brag that Britain, which had 1,200 plus tariffs when he first entered government 60 years before, by the time he was prime minister for the fourth time, only had 12 tariffs. It was the freest free trade country and the strongest and richest country in the world.
We believe today that we are immune, sort of, from any kind of revisit of Smoot-Hawley or excessive tariffication or excessive protectionism, because we think, well, we learned our lesson from the Great Depression, and it won't happen again. Is that true?
We learned some important lessons from the sky-high tariffs of the 1930s. They were a major contributing factor to the depth and duration of the Great Depression. And today, you don't find calls to restore tariffs to that lofty level, but you do have occasionally some protectionist calls to protect this industry or that industry. So far, in the last few years, we've resisted many of those, but I would have to say the world has learned a lot from the painful experience of trade barriers in the 1930s. If we had remembered Adam Smith in the 1930s, we wouldn't have adopted those high tariffs, because he explained 150 years before why doing so would be very harmful.
But that's precisely what's worrisome. You can forget the lessons of history, and there is talk of protectionism in Europe right now.
That's right. We have to resist it steadily, and a good way to do that is to remind people of what Smith told us all those many years ago, because his fundamental principles behind free trade and against protective tariffs still hold today. Those are still very powerful arguments. Ultimately, trade is a two-way street, as Adam Smith pointed out. You cannot close the door to imports without almost simultaneously closing the door to exports.
One thing strikes me as ironic, and I don't know how Smith would feel about it if he came back today. Free marketers, who in a sense are his spiritual heirs, his descendants, are also obsessed with sound money, and many of them are arguing for a gold standard, which is the very thing that he was fighting against. And I find that ironic. I mean, it's come full circle.
Well, Smith was not opposed to a gold standard. In fact, when it came to matters of money, I think he would be strongly in favor of a sound money, probably a gold standard. What he was opposed to was this idea that you should regard gold as synonymous with wealth, and that you should regulate trade so that instead of goods coming into the country, you just have gold or gold and silver. But I think he would be friendly to gold as the basis for our money. He just wouldn't want you to regulate trade in such a fashion as to try to heap up piles of it, because he argued that gold is just a means to wealth. It's not wealth itself, and all the gold in the world will leave you starving if you can't get goods and services with it.
One thing that struck me about Adam Smith in his correspondence, when he's talking about his own life, on two or three occasions, he mentions that he was particularly happy at such and such a moment in his life, when he's teaching at this or that school, or when he's writing The Wealth of Nations, and he seems to have had a knack for happiness. It's intriguing, because usually revolutionary writers who are critiquing their society and trying to upend it, these are usually very angry people, but he seems to have been sort of the harmonious type.
Yes, I think when one comes to have confidence and understanding in how people in free societies act and interact, well, then you're sort of at peace. You're not the kind of guy who wants to run everybody else's life for them. If you're that kind of a person, well, you're bound to be unhappy, because people just aren't going to do what you think they always ought to do. So, I think he was essentially a happy guy, because he realized his job wasn't to regulate your life, it was to try to regulate his own. And for most people, that's a full-time job.
And finally, Why did you tell your undergrads not to read the whole book?
Well, because I gave them a lot of other assigned readings, and I felt if they read all of The Wealth of Nations, they'd never get to the other stuff. It's a long book, but it's a very good one.
Yes, that's right, and I think that today we can recommend it wholeheartedly.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, some people, when they read it, they say, well, it's written in the English of the 18th century, and makes it a little bit difficult, but I think it also makes it quaint and fascinating. There's a certain precision and elegance in the way he wrote 200 years ago that I think is quite endearing.
Well, Professor Reed, this has been extremely enlightening, which is appropriate because you took us back to the Age of Enlightenment. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Lawrence Reed was our guest on the Free Markets series of The World Show. And that's our program for this week. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.